There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations, throwback time at Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I spoke with noted singer-songwriter Dion DiMucci on Friday, March the 25th, back in 2016. He first came to prominence in the late 50s, backed by the Belmonts, and then later as a solo artist. We talk about his career, beginning with his earliest influences, Hank Williams and Jimmy Reed, leading Dion to exclaim, "I don't sing white, I don't sing black, I sing Bronx." We discuss that fateful tour that led to the day the music died, which he was a part of. We also cover his battle with drug dependency, and we speak about his then-latest album, New York Is My Home, which provided us with our then-coolest song in the world, Ride With You. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my interview with Dion at your Coolest Conversations Throwback, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Here I am, girl, standing in the rain.
Here, and I am so very honored today to be speaking with Dion as part of our Coolest Conversations. Hey man, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing excellent now that I got you on the line with me.
The music keeps me young.
All right. Well, speaking of the music, we just took a listen to Ride With You. It's this week's coolest song in the world. And at the top of the song, there's that motorcycle revving. Now, is that a sound effect, or did you haul a bike into the studio?
A sound effect, but I do take a bike out every once in a while, you know. So it's like my, it's a ride song, you know. You got to be on the road and turn it up. So, yeah.
So what's your favorite bike?
Well, I like Hollies, you know. I mean, you know. To me, I'm a low rider.
Any fascination with British bikes, BSAs, or Triumphs at all?
Nah, I'm like I've been driving this bike for years. That's about it. You know, I don't go out on with the guys on Sunday or anything. I just take it out once in a while and, you know, feel the air and free up my brain and play some good music in my, you know, as a ride, and it's a way to free myself up, you know.
Well, you got some great music happening on this new album, New York Is My Home, and that's the title track. I know you released that as a single last year, and that's got fellow New Yorker Paul Simon on it. But most of the album, the new album, draws on the blues, and so too have your last several full lengths. And I know a lot of 50s rock and rollers, and here I'm thinking of rockabilly guys. Early on, their sound, you know, may have been rooted in a lot of blues and revved up R&B, but they migrated to country stuff. What accounts for your musical home with the blues?
Well, you know, I was I was raised up on Hank Williams. You know, I got fascinated with him when I was like 11 years old. You know, I was a kid from the Bronx, and I ran into this country station out of Newark, you know, in Jersey, and I was from New York. Nobody played country music in New York, but I got fascinated with Hank Williams, and then late at night, I'd tune in this a blues station out of Wheeling, West Virginia, and I heard Jimmy Reed. So I think, you know, the way I define it today is if I could communicate like Hank Williams and groove like Jimmy Reed, I'm on the right page. You know, I was like, that was it for me. You know, that just turned my life around. So I don't sing white, I don't sing black, I sing Bronx. You know, it's like black music filtered through a Bronx neighborhood comes out with an attitude. And that song Ride With You is about a guy who, you know, for some reason he sees that his girl has, you know, sees great potential in him. So he makes a decision to turn towards the sunshine and embrace truth and goodness and beauty. And if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, let's go together. So that's the way that pans out, that song, you know.
Well, let's talk some more about the new album. I know it's produced by Jimmy Vivino, you know, Conan O'Brien's band leader, and he also wrote several songs with Mike, and am I saying his last name right, Aquilina?
Well, Mike, yeah, he's my, like, I co-write some stuff with him, but, you know, I define the blues as the naked cry of the human heart longing to be in union with, you know, God or your creator, you know, and the blues, you know, if you took the Psalms in the Bible and had to, those are songs, you know, King David wrote the Psalms, a lot of them. But if you had to retitle them, you could call them the blues, because they're all about brokenness and people that are damaged and crying out. And it has, you know, they're outsiders. They want to feel connected. So, and the blues, it's a great form of music. I mean, it dropped out of heaven. You could express your joys, your fears, your love, your confusion, your anticipation. Anything you want to express, you could express within those three chords. That's why I've always loved music, man. You know, I found that out as a kid. When I wrote a song, I could make sense of the world within 3 minutes, you know. Within a three-minute song, I could tie it up, and it just gave me a handle to, like, the salvation, you know. So I still love writing, and I feel more relevant today than I did when I recorded Run Around Sue, The Wanderer, and Abraham, Martin, and John, you know. Mm-hmm.
So how did you hook up with Jimmy Vivino as a producer?
Jimmy Vivino and I have been friends. Oh, we go way back. You know, he's from Jersey and from New York, but we came together in the 70s. And I always say, if I could play guitar like Jimmy Vivino, I would. And I always wanted him to produce an album for me, and it never came about, you know. And now's the time, the place, and it just worked. I had the songs. He loved the songs. He said, let me do it with my band, you know, Mike Merritt on bass and James Wormworth on drums, and Jimmy, you know, two guitars, bass and drums. And man, we rocked out, and you could tell the fun we were having. I mean, you listen to the first song and you listen to his solo, the song Aces Up Your Sleeve, and the guy's insanely, he's off the charts as a guitar player. I love, and he has great sensibilities, you know. So it was the right time. For some reason, the stars were in the right place, and we hooked up, you know.
Well, you also do a song on the album with Scott Kempner called Visionary Heart. I know Kempner was in the Dictators and later formed the Del Lords. But you two guys played together in a project called the Little Kings. Did they ever play?
Yeah, we put a band together in the, yeah, it was in the 90s. We played the Village. We were bouncing around, just rocking out, you know. Yeah, it was a good time. It was fun. We got an album out of it. But, you know, I was talking to Scott one night about Buddy Holly, and when I was on that tour and
yeah.
won the coin toss, and I didn't want to go on the plane because it cost $36, and that's what my parents were paying up in Bronx, New York. And I was telling them about the, you know, by the time I finished the story and told them I knew 40 Hank Williams songs, and we used to jam in the back of the bus with Buddy and Richie Valens, and before the fatal plane crash that killed Buddy and Richie Valens. By morning, we had the song written, because I was telling him, you know, Buddy Holly was a visionary, and he just saw the future with great wisdom and imagination and great love and great beauty, and he loved the music, and he was a very stately kind of guy, you know, but a free abandoned rock and roller when he got out there with his Stratocaster.
Yeah.
So by morning, we had the song written, and what the song, basically what that song is based in was... It was a dream I had, and it's an imagined conversation between Buddy Holly and I, and it's called Visionary Heart. And Scott Kempner, he's the quintessential rock and roller to write with.
Well, last week you were at South by Southwest, is that right? You were scheduled to be a keynote speaker?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I spoke at the convention. That was a trip for me, because there's a band in every saloon, it was a great trip for me, and I enjoyed it.
Did you get a chance to check out some of these bands in the saloons?
I did some. You know, I was checking out different things, different speakers, and.
So give me an idea, what was your speech? What did they ask you to talk about, or did you just talk about your some of the same stuff we're mentioning here, your growing up and musical influences, or?
Absolutely, yeah, it was like from A to Z, you know, like it was just like how I started out with street music with I put a group together called Dion and the Belmonts, and we sang doo-wop. You know, doo-wop was street music. It was like rap. It was like, you know, doo-wop to hip-hop, you know. And you know, now they dress up in suits, but so I told them, you know, like how I started out on with my guitar as a kid with a lot of Jimmy Reed and Hank Williams, and how when I got a record contract, they wanted me to sing with a group. So I kind of recruited the best, you know, mm-hmm. vocal, guys in my neighborhood, and we put a group together. And then when I had hits like I Wonder Why, Teenager in Love when I was about 17. Then I went to Columbia. You know, I had Runaround Sue, The Wanderer, Ruby Baby. Then John Hammond Sr. Saw that I had a flair for the blues, and I got very involved. He loaded me up with Robert Johnson album, the Robert Johnson album, and Fred McDowell and Leroy Carr, and you know, some of these guys that were Lightning Hopkins, and you know, I'm still the same, you know. I just love getting out on the stage and taking the stance with my telly and just rocking out. I've really never changed after all these years. It still turns me on, you know. So basically, you know, I fill that in with a lot of different stories about how I recorded Abraham, Martin, and John. And, you know, in 1969, at the beginning of 1969, about you know, some of the leaders that were assassinated, and
right.
you know, and you could kill the dreamer, but you can't kill the dream. You know, we pick up on it and carry it further. So it was. There's just a lot of you know, and I kind of sang some songs to punctuate some of the different the times in my career. You know. And Jimmy Vivino had a lot of stories, and it was fun, you know. It was fun to share with the people.
So later today, Drew Carey is going to be on the air, and his theme for his another host here on the in the Underground Garage, and the theme for his show is acid rock, like a history of acid rock. Now, you were addicted to heroin at a young age, and you had struggles with it for many years. And it seems like, well, from my perspective, at least in the 50s, when drug abuse occurred with musicians, there was kind of an effort to keep things quiet. But by the end of the 60s and into the 70s, it's like the greater the debauchery, the greater the spectacle, the better. What's your take on like drug culture and rock and roll?
Well, for me, you know, there is no kind of creativity that comes from drugs. It's to me, it's a lie, and you know, I'm out to prove it. Because here I am feeling more relevant and creative after, you know, six decades in this business, and you know, I haven't had a drink or a drug in 48 years, so I don't all it does is destroy relationships and your body and your mind and everything else, so it's a bunch of crap for me. But you know, I saw the light. And, you know, I had a friend, Frankie Lyman, when I was a kid. You know, we were taking drugs together. And in 1968, February of that year, he died of an overdose. And I said, this is not good. And a month later, I just looked up to heaven and said, God, you got to help me. And I haven't had a drug or a drink since. So, you know, it scared me, and it showed me how senseless it was, how you just become more broken and more, that's my take on it. You know, it doesn't do too much, I don't think.
So in the 60s, you mentioned, getting introduced to John Hammond, and he's showing you all these different, or kind of introducing you to a lot of different blues artists. So around that time, Johnny Rivers is actually having hits, doing, you know, songs that Willie Dixon wrote or Lead Belly wrote. Was there any pressure from your record company at the time to say, hey, either do blues or don't do blues, or was that like an artistic thing you had to struggle with to record?
Well, it was. It was terribly frustrating for Columbia, because I was the first rock and roll artist signed to Columbia, which is now Sony, before Dylan came up or Springsteen. And I started doing blues in like 64. And Rob Santos over at Sony was going to release about 5 CDs that are unreleased. There's a whole bunch of recordings that are unreleased that I did with all the musicians at the Apollo Theater. And even in the mid 60s, I had recorded a lot of blues, and it's just sitting on the shelf in the back room at Sony. And in fact, they were going to release it at one time, and Scott Kempner from the Dictators, and who is the driving force in the Del Lords, he wrote the liner notes. The 5 CDs were going to be called Kickin' Child, or named after one of the blues songs I wrote in the mid 60s. But I was listening to Robert Johnson before Clapton. You know, I was listening to him when you know, meeting John Hammond Sr. You know, back in 62. So he was playing me that, you know, King of the Delta Blues singers back then. You know, so I got really hooked into that stuff. I was so enamored by all that music that I didn't even notice the Beatles. I mean, I wasn't into that whole thing. You know, I got into more the Stones as they came around. And Johnny Rivers was doing some good pop versions of that stuff, you know, and they were good records, you know, but I didn't notice too much. I was like hanging out in the Village, going to see Lightning Hopkins, and I was hanging out with Tim Hardin and Richie Havens, and John Sebastian had started his group. And the 60s were all about Greenwich Village for me. You know, I was down there enjoying Lightning Hopkins at the Gaslight, you know.
Well, a couple of things. You mentioned recording with a lot of the Apollo musicians, and of course you've got a track on the new album. I want to talk about that, the Apollo King, but a couple of things before I ask you about that is that I'm happy that you've kind of gone over. One is that I'm not sure that a lot of people realize that you were a part of that the tragic tour that took Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and the Big Boppers lives. You mentioned that earlier. Had you met those guys prior to going out on that tour, or was that the first time you'd ever met any of those guys?
No, I went on a tour for a whole month with Buddy Holly before that fatal plane crash tour. I have a, there's a YouTube video of it. It's called The Winter Dance Party. It's in HD. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came down to my house and they said, you know, we've been asking people about this and nothing makes sense. Will you tell us the story? I said, I never had the opportunity to tell the story. So I did. And it's about an hour long, and I tell the whole story. But I went out with Buddy Holly. I met him in August of 1958 when he moved to New York, and we became fast friends. I brought him to Manny's Music Shop, you know, with guitars, and Phil's Men's Shop on 3rd Avenue. They sold great sweaters, and we became friends. And we decided to go out on that. On that Winter Dance Party tour in 1959, you know, in January. And he was a great guy, man. He was a very interesting guy. He was a fearless businessman. He was like an old soul, very decisive, very stately, very formal, backstage. As soon as he put the strat around the show and walked out, it was all over. It was like, hold on to your ass, you know. It was like, the guy was unbelievable. So I just loved being around him, you know. And we shared a lot of dreams and together in the future and what we were doing. And, you know, and he said to me at one time, he said, Dion, he said, I don't know how to succeed, but I know how to fail. Try to please everybody.
All right.
And I think I love what he told me there, because I don't think I would have did Run Around Sue with a Wanda if he didn't tell me that. You know, I was like, I was 19, he was 22. You know, I'll show you how extraordinary this guy was. He chartered a plane. I mean, what 22-year-olds do you know that charter planes? I was 19. I was from the Bronx. I was learning how to hail a cab. He was chartering planes. So you could see how extraordinary the guy was. He was taking flying lessons at Teterboro Airport out in Jersey. He was opening up a record company called Taupe. I said, what's Taupe? He said, to you, it's tan, but to me, it's Taupe. Because he drove a Taupe caddy, you know, a tan caddy. So, and he opened up a publishing company. The guy was unreal. He was like just off the charts, you know. So, you know, that's what visionary heart is all about.
Well, you mentioned speaking with Buddy and then going on to do Run Around Sue and The Wanderer, that Ernie Maresca wrote The Wanderer, worked with you with Run Around Sue. How did you guys meet and start working together?
Well, Ernie was a guy from my neighborhood, and I latched on to him real early because he was the only guy up at the pool room who grabbed me and said, I wrote a song. And he kind of rattled it off to me, and I never heard anything like that. I was like 15 or what? So we became fast friends, you know. And, I had a guitar and I was into Hank Williams. I knew about 40 Hank Williams songs. I was crazed, man, for a guy from the Bronx, you know, singing about honky tonk blues and jambalaya. I didn't even know what jambalaya was when I was singing it. And Hank Williams, a lot of people don't know this, but he had an alter ego. He called himself Luke the Drifter. Yeah. And he did this album, with a lot of, you know, just full of recitations. And I learned how to live listening to this guy. You know, not only how to sing and how to communicate and how to, have a real, you know, insightful perspective on things and want to communicate that, because he moved me and I wanted to do that. I loved how he took me on a trip. I said, man, I want to take people on a trip like that. And that's what I'm all about. And Ernie helped because he put words together, you know. I just loved if a guy could rhyme was and buzz, you had me. You're the one. You're the one. You really give me a buzz. I didn't think I could last much longer, but it shows you just how wrong I was.
Buzz.
And you, that was it. I was in heaven.
Talking about Maresca there again, in the early days, you had mentioned recording with musicians from the Apollo. So on the new album, New York Is My Home, there you pay tribute to the late, great Big Al Sears, and the song's called The Apollo King. I know he's a sax guy, played at one point with Duke Ellington and some other jazz guys, and in the 50s he worked with Alan Freed. Tell me, what inspired you to write a song about Big Al? Tell me more about Big Al.
Well, listen, he was like, I guess you could say he was the original Clarence Clemens. You know, he had the white hat and the white suit and the white vest and the white shoes, and he'd come walking out to the center of the stage, and man, forget about it. He'd take you on a trip. And I wanted to catch the feelings I felt the first time my buddies and I went down to the Apollo Theater. You know, we ran up to Fordham Road, took the D train down to Harlem, and back in 1957, it was like going to a different world with a different energy. Yeah. You know, you walk up to the ticket booth and this exotic girl is selling you tickets. Man, that made it more exciting. You're a teenager. You take, you know, and there's all this anticipation. And, you know, once you get inside, the lights go down. You run down and grab a seat, you know, and try to get as close to the stage as possible. And Big Al Sears walks out with that white suit and that tenor sax. And this song is a tribute to Big Al Sears, that sax man who played wild, like they just let him out of a cage, you know. He just, and that's the feeling I wanted to convey, all that energy, and that changed my life.
Let's take a listen to that. We're going to go out with that. But first, Dion, I want to thank you again for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. You have a great day, man.
You as well.
Great talking to you, and appreciate it, man. You got great program. I love it. Stay well. Hey,
let's take a listen now. This is The Apollo King off of New York Is My Home. It's Dion and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Went down to Harlem Friday night with the boys.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.